Star Trek actually presents a very interesting thing when it comes to sets. Because the sets are designed modular. When the original series was conceived, what they had planned on doing was having sets that they could redress and rearrange to repurpose for other things. So in doing so, everything is designed very panelized. The corridor panels are very specific. They're 4x8 with a 2x4 section on the top. Angles and sections are designed that way with spacers in between so things could be rearranged. On the series itself, they did a couple of very interesting redresses. Is anybody here a pretty big Star Trek fan? I might recall an episode of the original series where they had a couple getting married in the chapel on the show. That's the transporter room. Slightly redressed. A couple of wall panels moved around, some covering thrown on top of something else, and some wall panels put up on top to block part of the transporter platform. That is the transporter room. It's amazing what you can do moving a few wall panels around. But the biggest challenge that we face is, generally for us with Farragut, is we have limited space and we also need portability. We need to be able to put together a set and then take that set down and put it somewhere else to put it away. We don't have a permanent location to house a set. So not only do we have to design it with a panelized thought in mind, we have to design it with panelized, put it back on a truck, and take it somewhere in mind. So that actually presents a whole new challenge. So we've worked from some of the blueprints and photographs and drawings from the original series and taken those and broken those down into our own blueprints so that we have panels that we can break down, move, and become portable. So we've actually had to make our set more portable even than they did. Which is a very big set of challenges, but so far we've been pretty lucky with it.
It's also interesting to note in the captaincy, the captain's quarter, filmed that portion first, and then a lot of those wall panels were actually taken down and reused for other things. We used that for the that one wall that came out where the picture was mounted. That became the Klingons' entrance.
And you see the hatchway we climbed through is actually the lower half of the center hall of the captain's quarters.
And the top portion.
The upper half of that became the Solanai time device that the gentleman's sitting there.
Just
that
redressed.
Was actually the upper half of the wall flipped upside down, put an angle with a big U-shaped chunk cut out of the middle, and then redressed. So you try to reuse what you have, too. Part of that's economics. But part of it's also I have a piece that's solid. It's got a pretty good shape to it. I can use it for something else.
Right.
Oh, yeah. The question, not only do you have to... I can see how you need to design large pieces and think about them and how you can break them down into smaller pieces, but how does that affect the choice of materials? I mean, obviously you can't...
We have a materials issue that they didn't have on the original Star Trek, and that is our cameras are better. Even our less expensive video cameras pick up more detail than the cameras did on the old show. For the most part, wall panels on the original series were plywood. Have anybody seen any of the remastered stuff where they've taken the tapes and they've cleaned them up and got them to the nicest quality you can? You can see wood grain, you can see cracks, you can see caulking. So how do we handle that with ours? People keep saying, oh, you should film on high def. High def gives you a lot of advantages. The biggest disadvantage it gives you is you see everything.
Everything.
Now, high def, they said there's a lot of actors who are not going to survive high def television because they've got skin issues that you haven't seen. Well, you get the same thing with a set that we built. So what we have to do is, for one, to keep the cost down and to keep the weight down, but also to worry about a finish quality. What I found to be a great material to work with is hardboard. That brown, smooth face stuff. It's cheaper than plywood, but it's got a smooth, beautiful finish face on it that when painted can look to resemble metal, wood, or whatever other material we need it to because it really is nondescript. It's plain, smooth, and flat. The bad thing is it has to be primered and have more coats of paint done on it because it's got a smooth finish on it that needs to have done. And you can't be doing a lot of Bondo and film material because you really can't sand the face of that material because it does have a built-in smooth finish to it. Six and one, half a dozen the other, but it gives you more of a nicer appearance on screen than the plywood does, and it's pretty much about the same weight, but you have the limitations, you know, once again, and it's more than anything else, it's about half the price of plywood, too, so But yeah, you have to worry about, you know, the original series, when they would build the frames for the wall panels, they were 2x4s. So it's a 2x4, 4x8 panel, and they would tack the plywood on it. Mm-hmm. I generally use 2x2s or 1x2s for that mm-hmm. same frame because it doesn't weigh that much. So it's lighter.
It's
Mm-hmm. And it's easier for us to pack it up and take it away. So it's not the, you know, you gotta hope you don't have a fight scene where people are falling against the wall too much because it's not quite as stiff as the 2x4s were in the whole wall and go boo, 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 you know, so you gotta go a little bit. But you gotta make it light.
But it still provides a stability where you can hang your little doodads on it, mm-hmm. like your decorations yep. and your intercom panels and stuff like that.
What's the name for those things you hang on the wall? There's no name.
Greeblies.
GNDNs.
Greeblies.
Goes nowhere, does nothing.
Yes, sir.
So do you guys, does somebody else design this stuff and you build it, or do you design and build it?
A little bit of both.
He designs and builds.
Okay. We take, you have established things in Star Trek that you've seen. We don't like to mess with stuff that you've seen already. But what we like to do with Farragut, because we're a different ship, is say, there's no way you've seen everything. Why does the captain have to have the same quarters in every ship you've ever been in? So when we designed the captain's quarters, we said, look, I think the captain in the original series got kind of ripped off. There's not that many windows on the damn ship. He should have a window. So we designed him a different room that had a bigger office space and a personal space, because there's no ready room or captain's office on that. So we gave him a bigger quarters with a more public and private space and a window. So we took the design concept from the original series and made our own interpretation of a different space. In pre-planning, like we're doing now for the next episode and two vignettes that we're shooting that involve the shuttlecraft, almost every time you saw the shuttlecraft interior, the configuration was slightly different. Galileo 7 was long, Mutiny Syndrome was really short, the next one was semi-long. They changed it a lot. So what we said was, and particularly for episode 3, when I wrote the story for that one, I wanted to show a long-range shuttlecraft, one you'd be in for a couple days. Well, if you're going to be a shuttlecraft for a couple days, it has to have a place to sleep, right? So we're designing a shuttlecraft that's in long-range mode. It's got a sleeping berth in the back. You're not going to see the berth, but you'll see a mid-panel door put into it with like a three-seater in the front and then a mid-panel thing with a door. But then we're going to redress that for Rock and a Hard Place, we're going to make it like a two-seater. We'll move the door up, or we'll put some kind of thing there. Who knows what we'll do with it? We may show it six different ways to Sunday, so it looks like we're using four different shuttlecraft. But it's a neat set for that purpose. By simply adding more sections on the walls, I could turn it into a Galileo 7 shuttlecraft that's making a couple more wall panels.
Yep. And actually, I have a follow-up to that question. How hard is it to get inside the head of somebody like Matt Jeffries? You know, how hard is it to say, okay, well, we've got this established technology, the established, you know, look at the sets. And when we build something that's going to be in addition to something like that, it has to look like it came out of the same person's brain. Otherwise, it's very disjointed. How do you go about doing that? If you go about, say, redesigning the captain's quarters, mm-hmm. how, I mean, do you go through a process of saying, well, you know, I can't paint this thing, you know, certain colors, or I really can't use this type of architecture because we haven't seen that before. Mm-hmm. Is that something you consciously think about? How hard do you try to make sure it looks like Matt designed it and is part of the existing set?
Let's put it in reverse. Rather than trying to get into Matt Jeffries' head, mm-hmm. since nobody really saw the captain's quarters other than Captain Kirk's on the Enterprise, we knew what his was. But because there were other ships that could be a different configuration, we chose to go ahead and take that route. Surprisingly, everybody accepted it very well and loved the fact that we took that beauty shot and pulled back out of the window. So it gave a sense of perspective of where the ship was, or where that room was in the ship. I think our whole perspective is not from being in Matt Jeffries' head as it is trying to make sure that we stay canon, because the first people that are going to just absolutely break us over the coals are the fans. This wasn't right. This wasn't right. Or that doesn't look right. You know, those things we tend to pay more attention to detail to. The props, the interaction between each other, the uniforms. So long as you can present, you know, people will give you, cut you a little bit of slack.
You know, I was thinking about the Enterprise episode, In the Mirror Darkly, mm-hmm. where they went back and created the Defiant. Mm-hmm. And they took us into a part of the ship that we'd never seen before, the right. kind of the inner bowels of engineering.
Right.
And as I was watching the episode, I kind of thought, you know, it doesn't look quite like it fits. It looks like there's all the other sets and then this new set, and they don't quite mesh up. And I thought it was just a little disjointing.
What you have to do, if you're going to create a part of the ship you've never seen before on something like Star Trek, what you have to do is, first off, figure out what is I need the space to do. What is it looking for? First thing we do is the captain's quarters. He says, I want to make a public area with a desk area that he can set, or a table area to sit down, and a private sitting area. So I'm going to need to divide it with something. Well, we'd seen a wall divider in it, so we expanded the wall divider. So we took the concept of something we saw and made a bigger, wider version of it. Had we seen rooms that had a beam across something? We had. So let's take that concept and do something different with that. Have we seen where a window might be located? Well, maybe not directly, but we know that the outside of the saucer had an angle. Let's look at that angle. We'll make a wall that matches and flows with that. So you take what you've seen, elements that you've seen, and it's kind of interpreting them, staying true to it, but interpreting them for what you need. We have plans on building for the next episode. You're going to see a corridor down in the engineering part hall of the ship. Why? Two reasons. One, it's not something you've seen much before, so we want to show it. Number two, easier to build in the saucer corridor because it's not 65 feet long following a giant curve. I don't need to build 400 wall panels. I can do 12.
Well, with your point about the Mirror of Darkly, I agree. When we do a corridor, we'll want to make that corridor look like something you've seen before. As opposed to in the Mirror Darkly, that engineering section or corridor was kind of round. You saw pipes that just seemed out of place, that plasma sort of thingy. There were neat ideas, but it did look like somebody had...
Overdressed it
and pulled it from another series, which they did, and plopped it into.
No, they didn't.
And, for instance, for all of some of the flaws that Franz Joseph had, he did a great job, I think, of just expanding the idea of what few sets we saw to an entire ship, and you just repeat over and over the same tables, the same chairs, the same corridor designs, so that if you were plopped down on deck 14, you'd look around and know you're still on the starship.
Yeah. As long as you maintain the visual illusion of the same type of elements, then you know what universe you're going to be in. What it boils down to.
I'm sorry, I came in late. I had two panels scheduled at the same time, so I just want to introduce myself. I'm not with you guys, but my name is Dawn Cowings, and my husband Shane Felix and I, we've made Star Wars Revelations and Pitching Lucas, and I don't know if anybody went into the Trenches panel yesterday, but that's our first professional thing where we're getting paid for that. So that's a new internet movie that'll hopefully be out in a couple months, and it's associated with Stage 9, and so we've made props like with the Star Wars stuff. It's all our idea, but we try to make it look like it fits in the universe as opposed to something very specific where everybody knows. But, where they're styling like something really specific. We just have to extrapolate. And then Trenches is completely, completely new, so we're designing our own universe. So I just wanted to let you know I'm in a little different place. So if you had any questions on who I was, because you're like, who's that girl? She just came in and crashed our panel. I'm sorry. I just, you know. We were kind of looking at the schedule. I'm like, wait.
Well, one thing you touched on, too, and I've heard in various interviews, people who are coming up with a science fiction film or TV series, they want to come up with a consistent look. No matter if it's a Star Wars look, Star Trek look, an alien, United States Marine Corps look, something that when you look at it, in 2 or 3 seconds, you know what kind of a film you're watching. And that was the problem with the Mirror Darkly. You had moments where you'd look at it and go, yeah, I know exactly where this is. But other times you go, where the hell am I?
How many people have seen our phaser rifle in our first episode of Star Trek Faraday? And you'll also be seeing it in Star Trek New Voyages, Blood and Fire. Does it look like it belongs in Star Trek? Yeah. Is it anything you've ever seen in Star Trek before? No. What we did was took the design concept of what you saw and extrapolated. I think that's a great word.
Oh, sure. You're welcome.
Extrapolated from that the idea of taking something, an idea we had, but making it fit within the style of what we were looking
when you,
for.
When you're working in a universe like Star Wars or Star Trek, the fans already know, like with Star Trek, okay, If it's next gen, there's these slick flat screens. If it's Star Wars, everything is, you know, you can flip the switches and there's actual lights. It's, you know, there's a different look. And if you want people to immediately feel like they're in that universe, you have to watch the different shows and try and just go, okay, if they use these kind of buttons or this is the color scheme they go with, if, you know, these are the textures, and you just put them in, you can design them slightly differently. But kind of like with, let's say, one of the big problems I think a lot of people had with the prequels for Star Wars is you're like, my God, it's so much sexier and newer, and what happened, you know, how do we go to the original trilogy where everything's dirty and grimy, and yet everybody's wearing all these beautiful clothes in the prequels? It's like, what happened? You know, it really is like they're just not in the same galaxy. And I think fans, you know, they really don't like that sort of thing. And I think when you're making something as a fan, the fans come down much harder on you than they do on a professional studio. So it's like you have to actually spend more time making sure your props, your sets, your costumes, whatever, fit that universe, because you'll be judged much harder by the fans than the actual studios would be.
That reminds me of this summer when we were doing the vignettes, and you guys were talking about what's involved, say, even if it's a non-speaking role. And we had distributed some of the information about what kind of jewelry you should or should not be wearing, what kind of hairstyle. Because, again, even though this is the 21st century, trying to recreate, not just in sets, but in costumes, makeup, and look, so that when you look at it in an instant, you know it's original Trek.
That's interesting. We've had people in the forums who literally will get after us because our hairstyle is wrong. Mm-hmm. Every facet that you could possibly imagine, they will get you on. And if it doesn't fit or if it doesn't look right, they're going to nail you.
My favorite thing is that any time we've ever tried to interpret something exactly, canon, this is the way it had to look, this is the way it actually looked, it's something you saw in Star Trek, and we're trying to recreate it. If it's not perfect, we get flack for it. Whenever we've gone off the other end of the spectrum and said, well, we never saw that in Star Trek before, so we're just going to make our own thing, and we're going to use it. Field jackets, phaser rifle,
they fell in love with
captain's
it.
Quarters. We get no complaint. When we violate canon 100% and go completely our own direction, they go, yay! When we try to make something that they've seen before, it's, we know the third button on the left should be green, not
yeah.
blue.
On the other hand, I guess you could look at it as at least somebody's watching this stuff, and yes. they are yeah. really meticulously watching your stuff with the same scrutiny that they're giving the studio.
How true.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, that's a compliment of sorts.
Well, you know, now we live in an age where I'm a member of some of the prop forums, and there are entire discussion threads where people analyze what button was used on what prop and how do we track down that original 1960s button, and they would just dissect that piece ad infinitum, and it can be very difficult when you're trying to recreate something 40 years old, finding the original materials, the original buttons and switches and things like
it's
that.
It's a lot easier than you think.
You'd be surprised how much stuff, and I know you guys did the same kind of thing, how much stuff you can do with found objects that people don't know what they are. My favorite, Greebly, they call them things on the walls, Greebly, of all time, I was up at the Star Trek New Voyages set, and there's this thing that comes out of the wall with this base on it. It's this comes out. It looks like some kind of a fire piping thing, and it's got the base coming. And it's this wild-looking thing, and it's really cool. And I said, James Cole, I said, where did you get this really cool thing? He said, it's a flower pot from Kmart. And he took it off the wall. Then it was a cheap $3 flower pot. And that's really all it was. He put some paint on it and glued a couple of pieces of scrap wood on it. And it looked like you had stolen it out of 1969 and stuck it there, and it was just a damn flower pot.
I think there's a trick to looking at your world very differently when you're making the props and not seeing it for what it is. I'm sure set designers today do the same sort of thing. It's kind of like every once in a while you just walk through the hardware store, and you're like, what could that be? You know, and then the hardware store people are like, you know, I'd like to help you. And you're like, what are you looking for? Looking for some hose for a Boba Fett costume. I think I'll go with this one, you know. I'm looking for, you know, and they're like, okay, you know, you look at just everything very differently. I know when the cockpit was made for Revelations, And it was really hard to populate it because Shane was just like, I want more stuff. It needs to look really busy like the Falcon. And so he went to the junkyard, and they just stripped out cars there and just random gears and stuff. And he's like, no, I need more. And somebody brought in something almost like a 70s lava lamp kind of thing, you know, and put that in. And then there's actually a record player turntable, but when it's mounted kind of upside down and painted a different color. And somebody's like, what is that little circular thing? That looks really cool. Or like, it's a birth control packet, spray painted, you know. And it just gives, you know, these little feels. And then you drill your little holes, throw some Christmas tree lights in there, set them to different things, and suddenly it looks completely different. Even, and I think, I don't know how you guys are, but for a fan film, it's like, the actual set feels almost like you could just walk into it like if it were a ride. It feels very real. It doesn't have, it's like you put more detail into it than an actual movie set where they might walk into it and it doesn't feel finished because they're like, who cares, you know, once it's on camera. But since we're all doing prosumer stuff and we're working with digital, you can pick out so many more details now. So it's like you really have to make it look as real as possible to start with.
Well, there's a balance. Like, Mike certainly understands more than most people getting the tricorder and the phaser to look just right. And on the other hand, like with the Solenoid Council Chamber, where you can go wild and come up with all kinds of really cool stuff because, yeah, and so you go somewhere where you can get a bit of both.
Mark and I, when we really set out to dress the Solenoid hat, I made him the console. And then Mark and I had several back and forth conversations about how we were going to dress the set. It's just the stage in the theater. And how we were going to dress it. And the glorious thing as it came down to the end was we hung white curtains on the wall and went over the scenes with blue painter's tape. And then we went in the back room of this theater and found some really good pieces of junk painted silver and, ooh, attach that to the wall. That looks good. And you see those neat panels with the digital things happening on the wall. That's just pieces of black foam core that we taped to the wall and digitally added in, you know. It was amazing what we did with you know,
minimal.
Literally what? And other than building the thing, John recovered those two stools, and then we had to completely. We brought the console in, and it was too low to the ground. We raised it up and put a black curtain around it. I mean, that was.
Had it sitting on a 5 gallon bucket.
It's sitting on a couple of empty 5 gallon painter's buckets. That's what it's sitting on top of. And it looks good.
Yeah.
We've had several comments go, "Oh, that device worked." It was like stuff I had laying around in my garage. I mean. I think the best prop piece ever. Anybody ever seen the original series Star Trek, the spacesuits that they wore, the silver? There's these things on the sides of the helmet. You know what they are? Styrofoam coffee cup lids. Painted silver and glued to the sides of the helmet. I've seen it, the coffee cup lids.
Yep.
It's just, they look great, though, don't they? They look like some kind of hearing thing. It's coffee cup lids. You never know? Yeah, you look when people are throwing stuff away at the garage sale. Garage sales have a whole new thing, and so does the dollar store. You walk through the dollar store and go, what could I do with that?
Yep.
I could use that. I might be able to make something out of it. It's amazing what you can find. A lot of the buttons that they in Star Trek are cast on ice cube trays.
Yep.
Always work. They pour the clear resin in ice cube trays with colors in it.
Now, with Star Wars, it seems a bit different that the hardware and the spacecraft, there seems to be a consistent design aesthetic. It's with costumes and sets where it seems to be so widely varying from film to film. And you mentioned the difference between the first film trilogy.
Yeah, the first film trilogy probably where they had no money, and that's why Princess Leia's wearing the same costume through almost everything. And suddenly, I have so much money, I don't know what I want to do with it. So let's just go all out and make this place what I'd really like it to be.
Like a Rebel spaceship from any of one of the movies, and you know it's a Star Wars ship.
Right,
an Imperial
right.
ship, it doesn't matter which time period, it's an Imperial ship.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to look at the costumes, you might go, what was that from?
Yeah.
Who wore that?
Right. I know, not that it's a costume panel, but when we were making the props for In Revelations, we set it on Corellia, which most people know Han Solo's from Corellia. This is supposed to be a little bit before actual Star Wars A New Hope, the first episode 4. And so we knew that in the extended universe, they mentioned this thing called Corsec, was the Corellian security, which was their military. And then they do talk about and stuff about how they want it to be, Carly is kind of like the smuggler's place. So we're like, okay, we want our military there to look kind of like maybe the British Rifle Regiment or something. Something kind of sexy, something, you know, a little bit of bright colors. And because they're kind of like, they're military, but they're kind of like pirates too. We wanted them to be, you know, not quite the straight-laced military that most people are used to seeing. And extrapolating that and trying to make your costume and the props for that fit into the Star Wars universe was kind of tricky. I mean, it was kind of nice because with the prequels coming out, you knew they could use more rich materials than in A New Hope. So we just tried to balance that with just little bits of color. And then we gave them, you know, the straps and everything. And I think it was the hardware store, some kind of little toilet chain pull or something. And these are, you know, a couple of washers glued on there. And, it, you know, and it gave it a little bit of, it looks like some sort of rank, but it still feels, it's tactile. It's not just, you know, little patches or something. And I think it's those kind of details that help sell you that you're in this one universe. Like, I would think in maybe like Colonial Marines or something, they do a lot of, everything's like patches, and that tends to make it feel more like our timeline. As a, you know, this is Earth in the future. We still do camo. We still do patches or whatever. Our props still look like just regular guns or something, as opposed to, I feel like Star Trek is a very hopeful, almost alternate universe for the way we're going now, where everything has a completely different design aesthetic.
But if you threw somebody in with a phaser and aliens, you'd know right away this doesn't work.
Well, I think, you know, the one thing we really haven't touched on, too, is when you talk about props and sets, how much the actors make the difference, how they handle and touch and utilize the props and sets to make it believable in the universe, too. And with Revelations, I think a great example is when you watch that, you watch Frank Hernandez flying the ship. Frank made that believable.
Yes.
The way he's hitting buttons and controls, I don't know what he had, if he had something in his head and what they were supposed to mean.
You know, he helped build it, and it was, so it was like it was his ship, and he had things figured out. I'm going to hit these buttons for this, and I'm going to do this for this, and, you know, as opposed to Shane, who's, like, not in the set a lot, and so he's just randomly touching things, you know. But, no, they have to, they have to not look like the set is fragile, which it is, you know. So they have to act like it's a very sturdy thing, and I can run here or there and hit switches, but not really, because, you know, they're very, you know, they're going to fall apart if I hit it too hard or something.
But it's a great example of an actor selling.
They have to sell your
set.
Props.
Yeah,
they have to believe this prop really does what it... one of our props is this little plastic square plexiglass thing that is the holocron cube, which looks completely cheesy in person. But our actress had to sell it like this was this very precious ancient artifact, and then, you know, special effects people throw a little bits of flare on there, and suddenly it looks like it's this great, wonderful, expensive crystal bit. But that is a good point. Your actors really have to sell your props. They can't treat it like it's toys. They have to treat it like it really is a deadly weapon. Mm-hmm. And then I think that really helps people believe that this universe is real.
Here's a good Star Trek example.
Go ahead. Helps up.
It's a great Star Trek example. They designed the phaser in the original series without aesthetically looking at a real gun, because when you naturally hold this in your hand like you would a gun, notice it's pointing up. If I hold this like I do a real pistol, I'm not going to sell this to you watching the show, because I'm never going to be shooting at you, because if I point this at you like I would a real gun with my finger on the trigger, like a pistol, at where you're at, I'm going to shoot over your damn head. I have to do this different movement with my hand to sell that I know how to use this weapon. And we've had to practice how many times on the set to make sure we're using one of these, to make sure that we are selling it properly. Because if we don't, it looks like we're pointing the wrong way because of the way the prop is designed.
Mm-hmm. An article that Mark wrote, when you're talking about how to walk on the bridge and around the captain's chair and down the railing without hitting yourself, there's sort of...
You had to bring that up, didn't you?
Yeah. Sorry, you've seen our blooper reel, if I Mike did not do it properly.
Let me tell you, James really has some nice sets up in New Voyages, and I think Bob will agree that the captain's chair is too close to the back rail. Doesn't give you much room to swing around. Well, that corner of that chair came out and bit my knee, and I took a tumble. Hurt. Bad. Bad. Wood is unforgiving.
But you begin to notice things that they had to do on the actual set to work around it. And
oh, sure.
This subtle little grab the side of the chair and spin it as you walk behind
yes.
it, because you're turning it and it clears your path. So it looks cool on stage, but there's a reason for it.
Know your environment.
Once again, it's selling your set. Another Star Trek example, talking about the same thing like we're talking about Revelations. You've got the control panels on the consoles on Star Trek. They're a bunch of clear, shiny buttons. They've got most of it doesn't even switches or anything. It's just clear, shiny things. Well, how do you make it look like they have a purpose? And then when we sat down and talked about the Solnai device, we sat down, Rick, for how many times did we go over?
Oh. Well, good chunk.
I mean, you practiced it for like an hour and a half.
And the same thing when Dean was on.
To make it look like, and I sat down with Dean, did the same thing. I said, you have to pretend that these buttons mean something. Like, before I hit a red, I'm going to hit a green, then a blue. So it looks like I'm doing something.
Yeah, oh my gosh, I'm totally drunk. Attack of the Clones. It's really annoying. When Padme Amidala, apparently this is the all-purpose button. No matter what she wants to do, she just hits the same button. Regardless of the fact that there's other buttons there. I want to talk to somebody, I'll hit this button. I want to receive a communication from over here, I'll hit this button. I want to fire a gun, I'll hit the same button. And so it suddenly, that set doesn't feel very real. It feels like it's a set because she's not really interacting with her environment. And yeah, that's kind of a really interesting way. I mean, I've never really thought about, I mean, when we've been on the other prop panels and sets, you know, everybody just wants to know, how do you make this? What are the measurements? But it's really just as important when you create your props to
Absolutely.
Put the thought into it and train your actors to interact with it properly.
I still get a kind of a little kick in the Solnai chamber. There's not much of being pushing buttons, but there's this one scene where one of the characters, I think it's Yusein, starts...
Activate. You turn the dial that didn't move. There's a dial above it that he's pretending to turn that didn't move because I glued it down because I lost the little stick part.
Pushing that button.
And then he pushes this big red button, which I had never intended to be a button. It was supposed to be a flashy light, and you turned it into a button, and he pushed it, but it looked like he was actually turning something on.
And the whole thing blows up.
Perfect. And then everything blew up after that, so we get to blame him.
Do not push the red button.
What makes all the difference are the sound effects also that
yes.
are thrown in post-production.
Yeah.
Because you know, you don't know until you've really begun to work with it that, again, as Paul said, a lot of the buttons on the bridge didn't depress. They don't do anything. Mm-hmm. They're just sitting there.
Just
and there is a specific sound effect of a button click that also goes with the touch tone phone sound
mm-hmm.
that happens with the button. And you put those two sounds together and you see somebody hit something, you imagine, your brain fills in the gap and says, okay, well, that button just depressed. Well, it never really did. So you can make up for that with sound. The other issue that we had was you sit someone down at the control panel, they want to hit every button. They feel like their hands have to be
Looks
doing
like
something
they're playing
all the
time.
And our helmsman and navigator are going crazy while they're sitting stationary. So they really shouldn't have been doing all that much. And every time they hit a button, our sound guy has to put in a sound effect. So that adds more work for our sound person in post-production.
Have a coffee. Just sit there. Have a coffee.
Yeah. It should be like, oh, there's orbit. So the guy should be sitting there, maybe.
You know, maybe what he should be doing is having a data pad. He can go, you know, scribble on the data pad like I'm entering my coordinates or something instead of Sudoku.
Were there one or two episodes of the very first season where I think Kirk was sitting in the captain's chair with a cup of coffee? I think we even saw Sulu with a cup of coffee sitting on the helm console. Give James Colley a heart attack if we were doing that, but
well, you know, we're sitting there doing Captain Queeg with a couple of data tapes, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, it can make or break. You can build the most magnificent set or prop piece in the world if your actor
I just keep thinking
selling
of
it.
Yep.
Natalie Portman just pushing the all-purpose button.
Explaining anything.
The way they hold it,
how you walk it, how you talk, you know, just how am I walking around the bridge? How am I just pushing this or not? Don't even have to say a word.
A great example, when it gets you in trouble on Star Trek sets all the time, you have to anticipate that the door operator is going to open the door because you can't look like you're pausing in front of the sliding doors. You can't like walk in, you know. You have to be walking like it's just going to open. Unfortunately,
sometimes
the pulley system does not always work as proper.
And you run into the door.
And you frequently find door and face meeting because it doesn't work right.
Or the door doesn't close.
Or the door doesn't close and you stand there and then John's continuing to turn. Now, there's the kind of sell the prop too much.
Absolutely.
It's on our blooper reel. There's the little handles in the turbo lift. You're supposed to turn them. You're supposed to change your floor, right? John and I step in. He puts his hand on it. He's supposed to turn the floor. The door got jammed. John goes. Like, John, it doesn't work. Now that's really selling the set.
Do you guys have any specific questions or? No. No, I was just.
Like for the Elijah Trek props, do you guys build them from scratch? Do you buy pre-existing kits like from Rod.com?
The only
and things like that.
The only kit that we did buy from Rod.com was a couple of tricorders that we used for the last episode from One Up and Nail. Those are now with James Collin for his stuff. These right here. This is done in-house. It's a kit that we made. It's vacuum form. It's very light. You stumble, trip with that on your hip, you're not going to break your hip. That thing's going to collapse, and that's what it's designed for. Very straight. You know, it takes maybe, there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4 pieces to glue together and paint it. With little things on it, and you're done.
But it's also good for anything that's not a close-up shot because it's lightweight. It's easy to keep with the Velcro to stay on
the side.
Absolutely. You get into some of these ones that they call the hero props. These things get heavy.
Yes, they do.
And if you've got a piece of Velcro holding this on, I've seen the Velcro work its way down off of your leg, and then you've got...
Pieces falling off.
You know,
I haven't finished it yet.
But, I mean, and you can have a very expensive suit. Sometimes you have to have dummy versions of props, you know, and the close-up hero version of a prop. Yep. It depends on the circumstances. Now, that's if you have the luxury of being able to do that. If you ever watch the original series Star Trek up close with some of the stuff, you're going to notice at times when someone's running or they have a tricorder on them, and it's an action sequence. If you look really good, it's a cardboard box wrapped in black electrical tape.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't going to take this limited number of really long, a lot of work props and have it get damaged by someone rolling down a cliffside. They just would take a little box of cardboard, wrap some tape around it, stick it on the side of Mr. Spock, and he could roll down the hill. So sometimes you have to create a dummy version just for the purpose of it can get broken.
Grab the communicator out of there. One of the things that always happens as you're walking, okay, you know, this is going to do this, okay? John had me go ahead and take, and again, this is not a kit. This is something that we've done internally. But we took two shells, took the bid plate. It's all glued solid. There's no way that thing's going to open up. It's very lightweight. This one here is actually pretty heavy. This one here is the hero one that has the movement.
You got the stopwatch inside?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is done exactly the way they were. But as you can see, it is very heavy. Those are ones you take out for the close-ups. But
in the first episode, when you're disassembling
exactly. When you come to those that you know, you've got a running sequence in there, but the one where the flap doesn't open, and you know, we learn as we go. We only have a short number of those that I produced, you know, for the show. If you ever get a chance to see the blooper reel that we have out, there's a sequence in there where they have Paul
jumping
with the Treasure Island, Danger Island music score. You can see first we can't fit him in pants. We can't keep him because he's always changing his weight size. But there's a little flap of Velcro that has never been sewn to his trousers. So every time he moves, this little flap comes up, and the communicator is riding up on it, and you'll see the whole thing go like this. And my heart just skips a beat because you know that thing's going to go flying somewhere.
Flapping, and it never fell off.
Never fell off, never broke, and that's it right there. But
that's
it's
the one, too. You know?
Yeah.
You see it when you're watching that, because they did it in slow motion. You've seen that communicator.
It does. You see it go up in the air and slam back down.
Oh, God, it's like 100 hours of work flapping around in the breeze on my giant rear end. You know, that's scary.
Yeah. If you, John had supplied a lot of props originally also, and you can always tell when he gets ready to toss one. There's some hesitation in there, And as soon as it hits the ground, you hear, you know, he'll have the little cringe in his face, you know. So you can always tell what he's throwing, what it hits. But it's mine, doesn't care, but it's his.
I mean, that's the kind of thing, too. I mean, we had in the first episode of the captaincy, crew comes up behind you, drop your weapons. And at that time, we didn't have the dummies made.
No.
We only had the hero ones.
I had a Greg Jean original.
So we had a very expensive...
Kept getting tossed.
Detail, and it had to get... The captain had to throw it on the ground. And he was cursing me for writing that in the script. And so we're like trying to set up all this padding on the ground so just to get it, and have someone laying on the ground trying to catch it so that it doesn't get damaged when it hits the ground.
So that's why we now have the vacuum form ones, and you know, those throw it against the wall. We got plenty, you know, and it's just they're easy to build, they're easy to paint, put together.
So you guys are smart in this. We had one gun. Well, Declan has two guns. I think they were towards the end. We, you know, because we filmed the movie mostly in sequence. Towards the end, one of the lightsabers is supposed to cut his gun, you know, cut the tip off. And so we actually had real wooden dowels because the actors needed to have the weights on the lightsabers because we tried to use the plastic or, you know, it would just wobble or they wouldn't actually heft it like it was heavy, so they had real wooden dowels. So they're going through, and what happens is we're trying to film this close-up where the dowel hits the tip of the gun, and the actors kept kind of hesitating and stopping right before hitting it, and we had to film this stuff in the caves from 6 p.m. to 4 in the morning. So everybody's really exhausted because it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. We're just trying to get this shot. Shane is so disgusted, he goes, just take it and go, and the gun just shattered. And everybody just got really quiet and everybody's like, I'm so glad the director did that. I'm glad it was the director and it wasn't me. So then, you know, oh crap, now we got to try and glue the gun back together, you know, for the, you know, okay, use this other gun. But, it's not until, you know, you get further along, and, you know, of course, that was our first time ever making a movie. Looking back now, we would know you'd have to buy, make sure you get multiples in case it breaks.
It's one of the things that I saw, I remember from watching original Star Wars and then watching original Battlestar Galactica, when the ships blow up. In the original Star Wars, you saw pieces of the ships flying off. And Galactica was replaced by this CGI kind of gaseous explosion, and you don't know where it really happened. Now, I can imagine the model makers, every time they blew that up, because I cringe when I see that. A beautiful Y-Wing model, boom. It's
ouch. They really blew it up.
Yeah.
Were there any particular pieces you're still, you know, you haven't made yet? Maybe you're still researching, or have you pretty much recreated everything you need at this
actually,
point?
Actually, at this point, we've recreated everything that we need up to this point, unless certain people would stop writing things in the script that... I've got some interesting things to do for Fathers and Sons.
I've written a whole bunch of new props
I'll throw out a little teaser.
I've got new sets, which I'm cursing at myself.
Yep. I've got an EVA suit.
We have to do an EVA. We're going to do, not only are we going to do the silver space suit, but we're actually going to do an EVA version with the jetpack.
So I've got this jetpack to do with something that he can do here.
Found PVC piping is really good for jets.
Yes, but I still had to make it look canon that people are going to accept. So that's, you know, when the phaser rifle came to me to go ahead and do up, I get this block of wood, and you know their original intent was to take a couple of the P1s and put them in there and do that number, and I thought, no, it's not going to look right. So I didn't use any P1s. Got this. Wood is called padauk from South Africa, and it is an extremely hard
and heavy
wood. And I'm sitting there with a Dremel trying to carve out the angles. I mean, and this thing right here, where's the... Just this little groove right here. It took me forever with that wood to go ahead and sand out of there. That is a signature for a handle for... I mean, you see that, you know that's TOS. So I put that on both the handles. I gave both handles on there that were, the metal ones there. Added in a couple of things, and for those who don't know, Mark Hildebrand in the first one played Klingon Krug. So when you actually looked into the site, what you saw on the screen, what he was actually looking at, there's a picture of Klingon Krug in there. So there's little tidbits on it.
Inspiration.
Yes, yes.
But you know, the thing is, too, and that's when you get into the challenge sometimes, you might want to write something into a story, and you're writing something maybe you haven't seen before. We talked about the spacesuit for episode 3 that we're going to start in the fall. One of the other things that we decided we wanted to show in that one was something you'd never seen on a TOS ship before is an airlock. Had to be there. It's a spaceship. Got to have a way to get out. Where are they? You know where they were in the movies because they had big round holes with doors on them all over the place. So we had to come up with a way to show that. So that became more of a challenge for our special effects team. How are you going to show an airlock on the outside of that ship without changing how it looks?
And speaking of something like that, like when you have to design your set and the CG person or whatever, the modeler, like for instance when we did Declan's ship, they spent, Shane and the CG artist spent, I don't know, months trying to just get the ship just right. And so that was like 6 months before we ever film it. So that's good. They're working on it. They're starting to do all these things. And suddenly it's time for them to build it. And they're like, he's like, what the hell am I going to do? The windows are at this angle. There's so many angles on here. And then he had to build a set tall enough for people to stand up in. And then suddenly it was up to the CG artist to dictate the dimensions so that the set person could actually build it. And as they were building it, it became really difficult because your angles all had to match, and you had to see if I had four people in here, where would the seats be, how much room to really sell it that they're in the same thing. So like you're saying with the airlock, if you know how big it is on the ship and you've seen it on the outside, now you've got to make your set match, how much, you know, room in between, how many hatches are in between. I can just imagine. And suddenly it's like, I never really thought about this problem, and now I've got to build it. And then it's got to be sold that, yes, you believe when you see the reverse on the outside.
And it's not unique to fan films. There's still Andrew Probert's drawings of the rec room and the officer's lounge that do not match up with the actual filming set at all.
Lost in Space, Jupiter 2, exactly.
But I think when you do that kind of detail, it shows how much you really care, and people... helps them again buy into it. And I think people who watch don't realize in the back of their minds or whatever how much their information they're taking in and at exactly at what point they lost interest. Like I do more of the costuming and the props end, but shoes are so important. So, you know, in shoes you could say it's costume, it's prop, but you could just totally lose people. You've got this beautiful thing, they walk down the hall, the shoes are wrong. Or with the props, with the guns, we actually had them weighing a lot, and the same thing with the saber, because it changed the actor's walk. And when we put in a lighter weight thing, they didn't feel it, so their walk changed. So then you'd have to make sure that, you know, when the strap is in a certain way and they had to learn their walk and the use of the prop. I was thinking of, like, the way Princess Leia fires the blaster in A New Hope, and she's supposed to be this, you know, when she's firing at the stormtroopers or whatever, and it's... I feel like you don't believe it. Same thing with Aminal, because when she's shooting at the droids or whatever, her arm's just going like this. It's like, are you sighting on here? I mean, are you that good? And Princess Leia, who closes her eyes and turns her head every time. It's like, I can't believe you really shoot. You know, you don't work with your prop. And, you know, is there a recoil? Is there not? And I know, like, when they're making, today when they make movies like Matrix or... Tomb Raider or something, they have to teach the actors when they're firing not to close their eyes, because it's instinct, I guess, when you fire to kind of flinch or close your eyes. And they're like, if you're this crack shot, if you're very comfortable around weapons, you can't flinch, you know, you can't do that. And I think you have to teach your actors when they're working with these kind of props the same sort of thing. This is, like we were saying, the deadly weapon. You wouldn't flinch, you wouldn't turn your head. You have to decide how much recoil, and for this weapon, then that means everybody has to consistently have that same sort of recoil. Otherwise, you're not selling that prop.
Yeah, if you're making a point in the story where somebody's an amateur, then it works great.
Right.
Conversely, we had, in For Want of a Nail, we had the captain handling a musket. And when he holds it for the first time, it took several times of working with him on the scene to get the sense that the actor has to communicate that he's holding something new for the first time. And when you grab something that's new, especially if it's a weapon and it's heavy, one of the things you do is you feel the weight. You actually make that little gesture. And adding that little nuance to the scene made it believable that, yeah, here he is. He's holding something tangible that he's seen on the wall maybe before, but he's never really held.
I liked it even better when Eric, the security guard who picks it up, He's holding it like, what the hell is this?
Holding it wrong.
Completely wrong. Because he's never seen this before. I think this is a rifle.
Yeah.
He doesn't even know what the hell it is. And the way he's holding it, it's so apparent that it could be a dead fish.
Did you bring one of the Apollo phasers?
Yeah, that's it right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, one of the differences with that is that's incredibly lightweight. And so you've got to communicate if you're using this even for a second. You know, this weighs, what, 4 ounces?
Probably, yeah.
You know, you got to make it feel like it's...
Yeah, got some heft to it.
Yeah, so...
We had, in episode 1 of Farragut, the captaincy, we had the gaggle of Klingons. We're supposed to be attacking Captain Carter and party.
Oh.
And we had this one female Klingon, and I just... she had the Popeil Pocket Fisherman.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And no matter how many takes, we ended up having to use one of the takes because I could not get her... She's going bang, bang, bang. It's like you're not casting rays at people.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, take that. I mean, it's like she was casting for fish.
There's a lesser speed on that.
She was casting for a fish, and I just could not get her to understand you don't. Even if it's a real gun, if you shot it like this, you'll never hurt anyone.
Right. Well, that's exactly how Natalie Portman shoots. She's just in the arena like this. And you're like, what are you shooting at?
What's the equivalent of the old Hollywood movie with the guy driving down the road like this?
Right.
The car would be doing this
exactly.
All over the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so you really have to, and it goes back to the whole idea of kind of selling it. And you brought up a great point, though, that with like the weight and the feel of something. That's why, you know, it's something that's really important, why we need to switch to a hero prop.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for the close-up appearance, but also sometimes, like Mark's saying, it's how it feels and weight in your hand.
I was at a Celebrations, of course, there's a million Han Solos running around or something like that. And you can tell who actually feels like they're in their costume or whatever, because a lot of them are using the little lightweight plastic toy ones, and they're walking normally, but if somebody has the actual... I did actually manage to find the gun that they used, that they modified, and it's really heavy. And I found it in a surplus store hanging up on the wall, and they had this, somebody just drilled a little metal rifle butt to it, you know, and so it's weird. It's like a pistol with a rifle butt on the end. And I was like, oh my God, it's Han Solo's gun. How much for that? And I'm like, dear God, that thing's been hanging there forever. You know, $40? You know, yeah, okay. You know? Yeah, like, what are you using it for? That's Han Solo's blaster. You could have sold this thing for hundreds of dollars. But when you have that actual thing, I mean, I don't mean to keep going on it. It really changes your walk. And suddenly you've sold the character so much more. And it's, I guess... The props are so crucial, but it's your actor's interaction.
Well, we also got, when we did the movie the other day, we were asked, you know, why we don't do green screen and we use sets and so forth, and that goes on with that same thing. It's easier for your actors to have something tangible in front of you to work on something rather than trying to not only act, but pretend that there's a surrounding that, you know, we go to New Voyages, and I swear to God, it's like walking on the bridge of the Enterprise. Every detail is there. It's a complete enclosure. Very easy to get into character. You've got your surroundings that you can work with.
Except for the squeaks.
The floor is absolutely atrocious. You know, you hear every footfall, every nail. You know, it's terrible. But it really gives you a sense of knowing where you're at when you do your lines and know
if
where
you have the
to
luxury
be.
Of building your set and then keeping it there, which we did. So we ended up using a lot more of the CG props, where you tried to have like a little green fabric over something and a little couple of cues, and so the person had an idea of where their space was.
Yes.
And then you try to limit what their movements are so that they don't have to interact with it as much. And give them their line of sight. For our cockpit that we built, I think it took them, they only had it for 3 months, the space, the warehouse. They built it for 3 months, filmed in it one day, and it was torn down the next because it had to be out of there, and it was just really painful. Luckily, I think it's sitting in an amusement park somewhere. Shane put it up on eBay, and somebody actually drove up, disassembled the set, and said they were going to be putting it in an amusement park. So, I mean, it was going to be everybody just in there with a sledgehammer just tearing the thing apart and just dumping it in the dumpster. But it would be really nice to be able to have
our experience,
a set that you could just keep.
A set of some kind is so wonderful. Even with the squeaks.
When we did the captaincy, you know, everything was done. A lot of pre-planning. Everything was done modular. Paul did some great setup on that, and we essentially gave all the you know, Mark came through with the finance portion of it. Gave all the work to John's dad, who just loves woodworking. Lives in Kentucky. He loaded the entire panels. Captain's quarter with the exception of a few things that you had. Yep.
The set dressing.
And put it in his van. Drove from Kentucky to Accokeek, Maryland, where we filmed it in my parents' garage. We put it up in a day. We came in the very next day and we filmed.
And then that evening, in an hour, tore it down, put it back
in the van, and it drove back to Kentucky.
And I tell you, we put in like a 16-hour day to stand up that set in 105-degree heat.
Yep.
In a day, then we spent about 14 or 15 hours shooting in it.
Yep.
And then spent another 4 hours breaking it back down.
The other tricky thing about having the set is you have to think about your lighting, and if you're shooting out the window, you got to have your green screens. So you can set it up, and you're like, okay, my set will be this big, but really you need so much more space because you have to run
your cables, your audio, camera, everything.
And then it's tricky to light properly, too, because maybe the cockpit's dim, but you need brighter light, and where's the light source coming from? And these are a lot of different things to think about when you're designing your set. So.
Makes a big. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's just it's the whole package, you know, and sending it to the audience. And I think the biggest thing that you have to remember, though, and I think the kind of productions like ours probably get into the same thing, is that I think sometimes we almost forget it's got to be a set. And I think sometimes we probably overbuild.
Because you really want to play in it.
Because we're so
I want to be in Star Wars.
But at the same time, when we built the captain's quarters, at one point we cut a corner in one point. Because we thought, oh, we're not going to see that. This is the one place where we can cut corners. And sure enough, every piece of footage saw it. So then you're going back the next time you go to rebuild something like that, you overdo it again. Then it's kind of like, no, I don't need to go that far. And he brings up a great point. You talk about the sets up at New Voyages. They're probably way more detailed than you would ever actually need to see in a movie set. But no matter what angle you film at,
you've got the flexibility up there.
You've got the flexibility. You don't lose this flexibility that I can't turn the camera over here. I can't film at this kind of thing because I've got all the
I think definitely if you've got a set you're going to be using over and over again, you can afford to put that sort of time
exactly.
into it.
Exactly.
With the shuttlecraft, Bob saw it for the first time this weekend.
And I cleaned the drool off of it quickly.
It is right console, or right console, left console, center console, and it's completely... It tears down in about 30 minutes. It was made to be modular, but when you look at it and it's configured and it's all set up, spot on. And the pictures that are out there on the forums right now don't do it justice. They literally don't do it justice.
Pictures and movies on the forum.
Yeah, it is tricky because I know when we Declan's cockpit was built, it was so amazing to be in there. All the cast and crew, when they walked in, they're like, oh, my God, I feel like I'm in this real cockpit, you know, because the lighting was right, the seats were right or whatever. And then you take a picture of it, like, it looks like a bunch of junk, you know. So then you have to really light your set properly. And I think one of the mistakes a lot of fan films or people make when they're making their own universe is they get the big wall, they spray paint it black or something, or they spray paint it gray, and they just have a couple buttons, and it was like, and then it's big. It feels like you're just in this big empty room. And so the space doesn't translate to the CG model they designed for whatever it is. And it's just, it's like, it looks fake. It's just plain. It's fine if you want to have something plain, but maybe you need to light it differently to give it some shadow and texture, because you wouldn't have this flooded light most likely in your cockpit, or most likely in a room, or if you're going to have a flooded light, put some light sources in there, even if they're not really your source of light, but at least we can believe that's where the light's coming from. But I think people just light everything flat, and when you have a set that is not as detailed, it just, I think, really emphasizes how amateur looking it can be.
That's true.
I think Matt Jeffries really understood so well is when you look at the original Trek and you see the different colored gels and lighting, and it's gorgeous.
Well, part of that was the lighting
gray
people.
Wall into beautiful splashes of color.
Part of that was the lighting people in the original series were stage lighting people. They lit it like a theater set, mm-hmm. not like a television show. No one had done that before, but they lit it like a theater set. That's where the colored lights and the
splashes. What better way also to sell color TV sets back then?
Mm-hmm. But that was what they were trying to sell. Color TV was pretty new, so they brought in stage lighting people and said, give me that. Give me these bright colors. Give me these colored slashes and colored lights and give me that. Maybe give me something that's dynamic. So people look at it and go, wow, I want to go buy that new color TV so I can watch this.
Yeah.
That's why there were so many differences in between the bridge set alone, between the cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before in the actual production series. They said, hey, we're selling color TVs here. Get some color on this set. Now you have a nice bright red railing, bright red doors.
Which, by the way, is really orange.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
It's red on TV.
Yeah. One of the things my husband did, he used to... when he was going to architecture school, one of the projects that he worked on with another person was on lighting, and they had to create a small model, and then they had to light it at various different angles and also use various different color to see what that would do, so that way to see the impact of it. And they actually also had to figure out a person in that space. And it was just a small model. It wasn't very big, but it gave them an idea as to how light played a factor in a setting, in a building, for instance.
Right.
I think the other mistake a lot of people make when you're watching different fan films, when they build their set, they build it so that they, as the actor, can maneuver comfortably in it. And that makes it, when you're watching it on the small screen, it makes it look like a very large space. And so you're like, gosh, but why would a cockpit, why would you have to take 3 steps to get from this end of the cockpit to the other end of the cockpit? And it makes the space look very empty, and they don't fill it up. But on TV, when people do 2 shots, they're, even though we would sit like this and have a conversation, when you film camera, they're really like this. And so the audience thinks you're sitting this far apart, so you have to get over that personal space. So your set actually really needs to be closer. And I guess that's why you're saying, you know, when you're walking through and there really isn't a lot of room, and yet you have to make it seem like there's a lot of room. You have to really sell it, because you want to have just one shot and get the whole bridge.
That's it.
If you were to build the whole bridge as big as it is, you would have to constantly be going like this, because you couldn't get everybody in.
How many times do we say, how's my breath?
One of the things too, like, you know, walking from one set on the upper rail, upper left deck of the bridge, walking, you know, past people sitting at their controls during the work, and walking to the turbo lift, you've got this much space.
Yes.
So you're walking, and you don't want to look like you're doing the sideways shuffle, but you have to, like, walk past, like I'm strolling to. But at the same time, you don't have a lot of area, which was really tough when walk there without hitting people with your hips. Mm-hmm. That was always kind of a challenge.
But I don't know if
that turbo lift.
I don't know if anybody's been to the Star Trek Experience in Vegas. Mm-hmm. But I could be remembering this wrong, because it was like 11 years. But I remember the set feeling very small. I know, like, when you see it, you're like, oh my God, it looks great. But everything's very close. The corridors feel very close. Mm-hmm. But that's how you can film it and make it look like it's really big and expansive. And you don't realize how close everybody is, how the ceiling is so much lower or something. But it's just it's something I think amateurs really just don't take into account. And that's why you notice the difference. But you can't maybe put your finger on why that set looks wrong.
Very true.
Did you all talk at all about filming underneath the transporter console? What you did with the lights and the illusion?
No, it didn't. There's a scene in the movie, the last episode that we did, where Bob's character and Holly's character were underneath the transporter control panel, working on it, and there was a bluish light coming down. It's a flat surface underneath. There's no open space or anything, so they're just, you know, touching different parts underneath there, and so like Mark says, every time an actor goes to do something, there's got to be a sound effect to give you that visual cue. You know something happened. All we had was a light that shined up on there, which gave a nice little reflection in there. I think there were a couple of times where we just went ahead and turned off the light, but we decided to have Bob's hand go across like he was closing a panel up, and the light went out as he's closing the panel. And it gave it that illusion that there was a panel underneath there as well. And it's not, it's just a flat surface that's just plywood.
Yeah,
There's no opening.
We did the same thing in Revelations where they go into the hatch. They jump on top of the ship. The hatch opens and a light comes out. Mm-hmm. And so we had to sit there with the light, with the yellow gel or whatever. And there was just somebody with some cardboard, you know, up. And those are the things when you're working, especially with minimal sets or you have to do some CG or something, doing as much real stuff, having the practical light really go in there and not have to go in and change it later or having somebody fan the wind in your hair.
I remember the scene in Revelations where Gina was walking down that corridor and the light from the windows as she was walking.
Yeah, there's these blue, what they did is they actually hung in the studio three blue spot gels.
And
then some other lights on the side.
Yeah, light the shadow. Uh-huh. I know it was a green screen that you had.
Right, yeah, no, it was. But she actually walks through these pools of light that are gelled to help sell
it and made it look real. Mm-hmm. Was that lighting.
And I think those are just little tricks that help sell your sets and your props. So they're really simple. You know, you think, oh my gosh, they're so complicated, but really it's just somebody with a cookie sheet.
Yeah.
Going like this, and ooh, I got a little breeze. My jacket fluttered a little bit, you know.
Well, our smoke in the Klingon torture chamber in episode one, we didn't have the fog machine with us, so it's actually several people smoking.
Yeah.
You know, that probably looks more real because the fog machine is
the
so.
Blowing around the room to give that smoke. Look, it actually was several smokers actually, because we didn't have a darn fog machine yet, and we said, boy, the room it's too clear. It needs to be smoky. Mm-hmm. So a couple went, okay, they lit up.
You know, but that's got to be better because we had the fog machine and it was so intermittent when it would work. And then we were actually filming in a bar where their ventilation system was really good. So you'd crank it on and huge puff and then the ventilation, suck it right up. You're like, ah, crap.
Yeah.
And it was actually pretty good. We opted not to go with that because then the CG artist was like, I can't really cut out the smoke when I'm trying to mat around everybody and insert the windows behind him. So it actually worked better that we didn't have the smoke, and then they just CG'd smoke in there. Much easier, much cleaner, you know. But
the detrimental phrase for the CG artist. We'll fix that in post.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. It's amazing how much you can fix in post, though. Any last questions? Or
thanks for coming, everybody. We appreciate your time. We're here till the end of the day at the Starship Farragut table. If you haven't gotten a DVD, please swing down and get one. Michael autographed pictures. He's a celebrity.
Yeah, right.
So. Which DVD?